Welcome to the Lob Podcast. This is our final episode that deals with the actual World Cup. I am Jim Hart, your host. I am here with Stephen Scragg, who has been with us all the way since January. How you doing, Stephen?
I'm fine, thanks, Jim. Hell of a ride it's been as well, and it's hard to countenance that we've reached the last lap.
It is.
Yeah.
It is the last lap.
It is the last lap. Here we are.
But we're ending it on two very interesting World Cups, I think. You know, it's a very different from where we started, right? I mean, with the idealism of people like Jules Rimet and others, and ending it on sort of the naked capitalist, just money grab of people. You know, having World Cups in South Africa and Brazil, and then announcing, of course, the following World Cups in Russia and Qatar. But to me, these two World Cups we're going to talk about today, the 2010 and the 2014, kind of reflect that naked capitalist expansion of FIFA and, you know, in some very interesting ways. You know, what are your thoughts about that, Stephen?
Yeah, I think for me, from my point of view, we've reached an era of, you know, the tarnishing of the World Cup to an extent. You know, the pimping of it around certain confederations and everything, that it just felt that much more uneasy. I think for me, by now, I'm, you know, by far favouring the European Championship as a tournament, which wasn't perfect by any means, and not averse to the sleight of hand of tournaments being handed to certain nations ahead of others, particularly Euro 2016 and how Turkey missed out on it at the expense of France, you know, under Platini's guidance. Which we can come to, you know, in another series, hopefully. But yeah, for me, I think the cynical side of it has certainly permeated the tournament for me. I mean, it's still, you know, a joy to see a World Cup upon the horizon, and you hope for the best. But for me, by now, that childhood, that inner child, has kind of become cynical to the World Cup and, you know, what it all means, you know, and it feels to me like you're not quite being delivered the football that you quite want. I mean, brilliant that the World Cup, we've said it just before coming on, is that of all the sins and evils of Blatter, you know, he did ensure that a World Cup got to Africa, you know, by hook or crook. You know, Africa saw its first World Cup under his stewardship, and it went back to South America. But as ever with FIFA, it's not where it gets, it's how it gets there. And I think these two World Cups, alongside the delivering of the host nations of 2018 and 2022, just left a bit of a bad taste in the mouth.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, as you said, it's a beautiful thing that the World Cup was held in on the continent of Africa, and I do believe that Sepp Blatter did do some very positive things in terms of expansion of football around the world. But he also did some really corrupt things, and, you know, I can never forgive him for certain things. And I believe we're dealing with a very different person now with Gianni Infantino. And we're going to see, right? We're going to see what happens with the 2026 World Cup and beyond. And, you know, it's a different world now. So
it is. That's the thing, is that, you know, for 2018, 2022, you can't change the venue, certainly not for 2018, this close to it. It's just how they deliver now on 2018 and 2022. And also on how they deal with the handing out of the host rights for 2026. It's going to be interesting just to see what they deliver, because now 2018, you know, I think you know, we discussed with Stuart at one point, was that it shouldn't hold any great attraction, great allure to it. But I think talking throughout these podcasts has suddenly brought the inner child back to the surface somehow, and left us looking forward to it. And it's up to FIFA to just to deal their hand differently now. And these are the tests now, this summer, 2022, and just what they do with the host nation of 2026. It's sink or swim now for the World Cup.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I agree. So joining us this week to talk about 2010 and 2014 is an old friend, a senior writer at These Football Times, and an absolute joy, a gentleman who's been a co-host of mine on this podcast many times, a wonderful writer, a brilliant man, our man in Belfast, Mr. Christopher Weir. How are you, Chris?
I don't really know what to say to an introduction like that. I think you flatter me somewhat. that's my Facebook right here, but thanks for having me. Well, I'm speechless. I'm blown away. Did you write that beforehand? Did you?
No, it just came off me. You know,
came from the heart.
It came from the heart, Chris. You know, I love you, mate.
I love you too. I'll have to write you something.
So for you, Chris, you know, I know you graduated from college in 2010. You're 21 years old. You're footloose and fancy free. You've got the World Cup coming up, and bam, you get this thing, right? This kind of stodgy, boring World Cup. What were your thoughts about that?
Well, as you say, from a footballing point of view, it wouldn't rank as one of my favorite tournaments. But for all the reasons you just quoted, it is memorable for me. And you know, most of the matches in this tournament I watched from a bar in Belfast City Centre, or an array of bars, celebrating my newfound freedom after graduating university. So this was the first tournament really where, you know, I didn't have anything to worry about. Well, other than actually getting a job, but that was put to the wayside whilst I enjoyed the feast of football. But there was enough going on, certainly on the field and off the field, to make this an interesting spectacle. You know, we had the Vuvuzelas, the infamous Vuvuzelas, the pomp and ceremony of the first tournament to be held in Africa. It was a fine spectacle. The sporting element was, you know, detracted from that somewhat, I felt. But that might have been down to the performances of England in particular in that World Cup, you know, and the coverage surrounding it. But I think it's interesting that we talked about FIFA making this the first tournament in Africa. I mean, whilst Blatter did do great things in making it, so, I mean, it's worth remembering that the only reason he did so was because all of the support in FIFA came from the likes of the Minnow Nations. So Blatter knew what he was doing. He was scratching Africa's back in the hope of getting something in return. And I admire your optimism about Gianni Infantino. I would caveat that by saying, you know, a FIFA careerist like himself doesn't get to where he got to without...
Oh, that wasn't optimism.
Oh, right. I...
No, that was just contrast.
Yeah, exactly. That was contrast, not optimism.
No.
I've been a son all day, so I things like irony and sarcasm might pass me by tonight. But yes, 2010 was great as a spectacle, but as a sporting contest, I felt it lacked a bit. I don't know how you guys
do. I think Chris there, I think he's by then reached that we've spoken to about it before on podcasts about how those first couple of World Cups that you're just so kind of like wide-eyed about, that once you get past that, then the realism of them kick in by the time you get to about your third one. And And it's, I think Chris is probably reaching the point there where it's the era of World Cups can only really disappoint because they can't live up to the ones of the past. You know, those World Cups that you grew up on. And that just sounds like a familiar tone from Chris there, from everything that we've said in previous podcasts. As each person, from Gary to Dan and Stuart and on to Chris, through the age groups, which has been perfect with these podcasts, is that, you know, we've married the right people to the right podcasts and the years that they've covered, because they've brought that enthusiasm for the World Cups that they first embraced. But yeah, here we are at 2010, me and Jim bitter and gnarled about it all by now, and Chris suddenly realizing, well, actually the sun doesn't shine from the World Cup after all. But yeah, he's right there. You know, 2010, it's an enigma. You know, it's great that the World Cup's gone to Africa. It's fantastic. However it got there, it had to happen. But yeah, as ever, with a World Cup that gets closer to this day and age, there's just so much that leaves you disappointed or wanting more. Yeah, you know, you'll still point out that there'll be some bright spots that you kind of overlook and forget. A bit like Costa Rica, we will come to for 2014, and for 2010, it's Ghana, it's Uruguay, Spain winning it, that everyone, you know, embraces the first European success in the World Cup away from European soil, but also a functional one for Spain. It wasn't anywhere near as ebullient as the European Championship success of 2008, or the all-encompassing beauty of 2012. You know, the World Cup success in South Africa was quite functional. You know, they won 1-0 every step of the way in the knockout stages, and of course they lost in the opening game, their opening game against Switzerland, in a game that they largely dominated but couldn't score, and Switzerland got their one chance and put it in the back of the net. But yeah, Spain just seemed to trundle to that World Cup, and I would have expected it to be something better, that when Europe cracked the code of winning the World Cup away from Europe, that it would take more than a succession of 1-0s to do it.
I don't know if I, you know, I mean, looking back on it now, Stephen, I don't know if I would say they trundled to it, right? Because I look back, you know, at one of the greats now, Iniesta, and Xavi, who retired essentially the year earlier, or 2 years earlier, sorry. And I think these guys controlled that game so brilliantly throughout that knockout.
That final is something else completely different. You know, that war of attrition that they have to get through to get beyond the Netherlands.
The whole knockout period, right? I mean, they really, you know, under Del Bosque's command, they really just, they played a different game than the other teams did. I mean, it was like, you know, it was, I don't know what it was. It was chess and Monopoly or something. I don't know what it was. But they were playing a different game than the other teams were playing, it seemed like.
Yeah, without a doubt, but there was just that lack of extension for me, for a lot of it. You know, they just did enough. They just did what they had to do. You know, it's almost like they did it in third or fourth gear. I just wanted that bit extra. You know, I wanted that ebullience to break through again. You know, it was so refreshing when Spain won Euro 2008, and then it was a succession of, you know, we're good enough to do this, but we'll just go 70% of the way to win these games. And it was almost like they were conserving themselves as the tournament went on. Yet that fruition, that final burst never quite came. because they had the wrong opponents in the final. You know, the Netherlands playing anti-Netherland football. It stopped Spain having that, like Brazil at Mexico 70. You know, that Brazil Mexico 70 moment for Spain came 2 years later in Kiev at the final of Euro 2012 when they dismantled Italy. That was the Mexico 70 moment, and it wasn't at this World Cup for me.
A brilliant man once said, "Every revolution looks obvious 20 years later." And to me, that's what that was. I mean, it just looks obvious now, right? I mean, the game changed, and
the game changed completely, and Spain, you know, embraced that in a way that no one else could at that time, and that seismic tectonic plate that shifted. Yet, you know, the fault line isn't out this World Cup. The fault lines, you know, fall either side of this World Cup. It's a bit like,
absolutely,
in a way,
the fault lines broke at the World Cup. They moved earlier.
Yeah, this for me is a bit like when West Germany went in 1974, is that they played so much better football 2 years earlier at the Euros because Netzer played instead of Overath, and they were forced to play a more expansive football where it was that bit more conservative by the time they played on home soil in 74. This was a conservatively won, you know, World Cup by the standards of that Spain. And it was still brilliant, but it could have been perfect. That's where I'm coming from there, Jim. It's I'm not picking bones in what they did, because what they did was brilliant. It was just that it could have been perfection. And I think that was what I feel that it just lacked, that.
We've left our guest out of this conversation for the last few minutes, and I really want his perspective on this. Chris,
come on, Chris.
Tell us old guys what's wrong with our arguments.
Well, actually, Jim, I think your quote there was quite prescient. It's easy to look back on Spain's triumph now and feel a bit jaded about it, but that's only because the period of dominance was so sustained. You know, after this, 2 years later, Spain go on and win the European Championship. And by that point, I would say that actually watching them be so dominant wasn't enjoyable. And I think this was the apex of the Guardiola style of football. You know, a lot of his Barcelona players were here, but, you know, now we were in the midst of his revolution at Barcelona. I think he just had his first season in 2009-2010. So Spain, you could say that they weren't as overwhelming as we had come to expect them or Guardiola's Barcelona team to be. But when you look at the opponents they beat to reach the final and win it, for example, we have Paraguay, who I think, if I remember correctly, could have won had Oscar Cardoso scored a late opportunity. You know, they beat Portugal in a very tight game in the second round. And Germany, of course, in the quarterfinals, you know, this was a Germany team that wasn't, you know, the behemoth that it would be almost a decade later, but it was still, or 4 years later rather, it was still a very talented squad, hosting Thomas Müller, who would go on to win the Young Player of the Tournament. The same Germany team that had beaten England 4-2. So Spain's inability to dominate was more a reflection of the quality of the opposition they faced. And when you put it through that lens, it actually becomes more impressive, because Spain adapted their game. They couldn't play the usual flowing, expansive style. They adapted and they triumphed. They did what they had to do. And in a World Cup, you know, that's what you have to do. Like, it's rare that a team comes in and waltzes a la Brazil 1970 all the way to the final. You have to triumph through adversity. You have to make the most of a difficult situation, and that's what Spain did for this. And it was the apex for them, because I think it was before Euro 2008, and I hope I'm remembering this correctly, but I remember seeing a banner being unfurled from the team hotel, and it said something like, "Being Spanish is no longer an excuse." Because before then, Spain without...
That's good.
They had a lot of disparate, as we all know, political communities throughout the Basque, the Andalusians, etc., etc., the Catalans, of course. Spain united from a footballing perspective, certainly for those few years. Obviously, whenever Jose Mourinho joins Real Madrid and the Barcelona rivalry really kicks off, that sort of fades somewhat. But this was the joining together of all those strands. So it might not have been as artistic a triumph as we come to expect, but it was a triumph nonetheless. And it's easy to be jaded about it now, but it's still very impressive.
No question about it. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of difference between that and some of the divisions that were occurring in the German side in certain times between the Swabians and the Bavarians, right? Where they had to bring these, you know, these philosophies together to say, come on, guys, we've got our own, you know, internal squabbles and these, you know, these different factions. Bring them together. We're all here for one. We're one team. Let's do this, right? Vicente del Bosque was really good about just saying, let's play. Let's do this. We're going to play this game. We're going to play it a certain way, and we can win this way. And he proved it. And I think, you know, obviously 2010 was the ultimate execution of that, but 2008 was proof positive that it could do it, that it could happen. But as we look back on the actual tournament itself, right? I mean, obviously Spain was not the most exciting team, even though they won. You know, we look at Uruguay, who had to play their way into the tournament, which I had to remind myself of that today. You know, they had to play a playoff game to get into the tournament, and they make their way to the quarterfinals. I mean, was this not the most wild ride of the 2010 tournament, Stephen?
Oh, certainly. I think what you've had is a succession of South American sides who stumbled through qualifying, but then the shoulders relax once they got there. We've spoken about it before, about Argentina in 94 came very close to not qualifying. Brazil looked precarious before reaching 2002 and then going on to winner. Argentina this time towards 2018, you know, I could imagine them going a long, long way on the back of previous rancor. And Uruguay fit this criteria for 2010 once again perfectly. Massively disjointed. This is the first great Uruguayan World Cup since Mexico 70. They've qualified sporadically between 70 and 2010, not being there on occasions, struggled to get through the group stages when they have been there. And this was just a very different Uruguay, because we became used to either Uruguay not being there, or if Uruguay were there, that it was the cynical version of themselves. And this wasn't. This was different. And this was, you know, an ebullient Uruguay side. And I think that's one of the things that kind of like jarred a bit about this World Cup as well, was that many of the South American sides that went to this World Cup played in a more traditional South American way. I seem to remember Chile playing some fantastic football at 2010, and it was very much a case of the birth of their side that would go on to finally win Copa America by the middle of the decade, and Uruguay fitted this bill. There was just a metronomic, you know, way about them, and they just played with a style that was just very forceful and very, very, you know, they're just very stubborn. We are going to play this way, and we are going to succeed, and it will be fast and it will be punchy, and Luis Suarez on the end of it was just so symbolic of that, even down to the way, the underhand way in which they made the semi-finals, you know, he punches that ball over the bar against Ghana and that, you know, Garner missed the late penalty in extra time, and he's on the touchline celebrating and punching the air, and it just how much it meant to him, and how much it meant to his nation. But then he wasn't there for the semi-final. But without what he'd done, they wouldn't have made the semi-final. Without him, they couldn't go beyond the semi-final. So there was that, you know, interesting contrast again. But they did. They played some great football on the way to that semi-final. And within that, again, another of the great lost stories about the 2010 World Cup is Ghana being on the brink of becoming the first African side to make the semi-finals of the World Cup. And I just think through that part of the draw that led all the way to the final, for it to be the Netherlands that made it, there were some big stories that were denied. The, you know, had Uruguay made the final, had Ghana made the final, you know, it could have supplied Spain with that Mexico 70 ending to this tournament, because you might have had someone that would have, you know, set out to play football against them rather than stifle them and try to mug them off in the final.
Well, there were so many teams that almost did it, right? I mean, there was Ghana, there was Paraguay, who made the quarterfinals, you know, and there was Chile that played Brazil in the knockout stage.
I think you can even point to a much more Brazilian Brazil in this tournament.
Exactly.
You know, because for them to beat Chile 3-0 in the last 16 was no mean feat. I mean, you know, that was a Chile side that could have won that game going into it. And I think most of us expected Brazil to make the semi-finals beyond the Netherlands. And it was a true shock when that didn't happen.
Brilliant match between, you know, the Netherlands and Brazil in that quarterfinals. It was just like, wow, that was a great match.
Yeah, but that was the South Africa looked so strong for so long in that tournament. You know, all five South American sides made it through to the knockout stages. You had Brazil face Chile, and then by the time you got to the quarterfinal, it was actually light of European sides. You had four South American sides. You had Ghana. So you had Spain, Germany, and the Netherlands. You know, the Europeans were in the minority at the last eight, which goes massively forgotten. That it looked like it was going to be a World Cup that would revert to type and that it wouldn't be a European success. But that was turned completely on its head in the quarterfinals, in the fact that the European sides won all three of the Europe versus South America face-offs. The Netherlands overcame Brazil, Germany overcame Argentina, and Spain overcame Paraguay. And that was something of a culture shock. That was, you know, a massive surprise.
And, yeah, Uruguay was the only non-European side to make the semis.
Yeah, and they didn't face a European side in the quarters. So, you know, that was the thing. I found that quite shocking at the time, that all three of the South American sides to face European sides on a World Cup away from European soil, and all three of them crashed out. It was very kind of like sobering incident.
So, Chris, you know, being the young man of the crowd, I mean, was it what you expected to have such a wide open field of, you know, so many different nations from CAF and everywhere else? Or was it, you know, did you expect Europe to dominate this 2010?
Not at all. And I think Brazil especially were their favourites heading in, and one of the favourites certainly heading into the tournament. And I think Stephen makes an interesting point about the progression of the European side and at the South American's expense. I think a lot of that has to do with luck. And I think some of it has to do with maybe maturity is the wrong word, but certainly in the Brazil game, you know, the way Felipe Melo got himself sent off, you know, smacked of an inability to handle the pressure at the tough moments. But I wouldn't necessarily say there was anything in it. And it wasn't a surprise because usually, well, not always the case, but usually the best teams progress the furthest. And so it wasn't especially a surprise for me from that perspective, no, I have to say.
But, you know, when I look at the makeup of the knockout stages, you know, I was a little bit surprised that the U.S. won their group, especially over England, because I think in 2010, England were a bit stronger than they were either right before that or right after that. Well, you know, Stephen, what were your thoughts on the 2010 England side? And why do you think the United States topped England in that group?
I think there was a lot of, from what I've read, I think there was a degree of discord amongst the England squad that Capello was, he was very strict with the squad. You know, there's the infamous statement from Jermaine Defoe where he said that, you know, it was such a boring experience that he sat and watched the entirety of Wayne Rooney's wedding on DVD. There was no concept of letting the players, not off the leash, but giving them, treating them like adults. You know, they went from kind of like Ericsson's soft approach to 2006 when the wives were allowed to be there, and it just seemed to be, you know, a World Cup squad infused by player power, to an old school way of approaching 2010 was that it was like a boot camp, and Capello just did not allow the players to enjoy themselves almost, and that seemed to transmit itself into the football. The England were very, very stale, very insipid. There was the mistake that Robert Green made in the first game that cost him his place to David James for the rest of the tournament. And I think the only time that they actually played with any fluidity was against Germany in patches. The 4-1 result, you know, whereas Germany, by far the better team in the game, the 4-1 result was deceptive in that way because of the Lampard incident where the ball drops over the line and then England are chasing the game. So it's a bigger margin of defeat than it probably deserves to be. But yeah, I think Capello, you know, that stranglehold that he had on that squad was just played a big part in it. You know, if the players aren't enjoying themselves being there, then they'll not bounce onto the pitch. You know, that there has to be some kind of common sense amongst that. You know, if you treat adults like children, then you won't get the best results possible. You know, you will not get, you know, positive response from it.
No, that makes sense. I mean, you know, I was really shocked that that the United States won that group, because I don't think the U.S. was that strong that year. But and of course they went out pretty quickly in the rounds. But you know, when you look at some of the knockout results, I mean, you know, that wasn't a very strong group at all. I mean, it was the U.S., England, Slovenia, and Algeria.
No, it shouldn't have been a particularly taxing group.
No.
For England, though, you know, I'll call England for what they are, but England shouldn't really have struggled with that group. But I think within that, you know, once you get beyond the group stages, you know, England kind of got what they deserved, really. You know, to be so sluggish in a group that they shouldn't have had a problem with, to end up having to play Germany, it was kind of like a deserved fate, really. And
but if you know, I got to bring it up, right? Because there's two great World Cup teams that just absolutely stank in 2010, and it's Italy and France. Italy.
It was. I felt for Italy because Lippi came back after Italy had flattered to deceive at Euro 2008 as world champions. Roberto Donadoni, I think, was in charge at the time.
Yeah, he was. Yeah,
he was. Yeah, So then Lippi agreed to come back, and it's that classic, you know, never go back theory. And Lippi lived that in his second coming in charge of the Azzurri, because Italy just could not function at the 2000. And this happens to Italy periodically at major tournaments, is that, you know, the such great value for money in the way that they will either self-destruct or they will shoot for the stars. There's very little in between. And this was just one of those World Cups where they self-destructed. But France were another matter altogether.
I think the disunity of France became...
Yeah, the classic unrest.
Epic. And,
you know, it was near mutiny. You know, the whole Evra, you know, incident, and Domenech just had no control whatsoever over that French squad. And the fact that they ended up losing to the host nation says everything. You know, the worst South African side to reach a World Cup since they'd started reaching World Cups in, I think, France 98. This was possibly the worst host nation of a World Cup ever. Very, very weak. I don't think they even qualified for 2006. But there we go. South Africa even picked off a victory against France at the end of that group to ensure that neither of them would progress to the knockout stages. And again, I always feel robbed of, you know, part of a World Cup if one of the megaliths falls in the group stages. And for me to lose both Italy and France, I'd expect at least one of them to get through there. But because they're just such great value for money, they just did it. They just loaded it at the front of the tournament. And they were a massive, France in particular, were a massive story at that World Cup.
Chris, what do you think about, what did you think when you watched France just implode that summer? I mean, they just absolutely imploded.
I enjoyed it very much because... and you know why? Because a year ago, Ireland played France in a playoff for the World Cup spot. And Thierry Henry, he'll always be one of my sporting heroes, but that night he cheated. France cheated, and that's how they qualified. And this was
I remember that match very well. Go ahead.
And this was the low point of a really disastrous, embarrassing reign in French football. You know, Raymond Domenech should have really been sacked after 2006. His job was saved by a flukish appearance in the World Cup final. You know, this is a guy who picked players according to star signs. You know, it's a player a manager who proposed to his girlfriend on TV and was turned down. You know, he was just a walking calamity. And Knysna was the absolute low point of this. And the build-up for the French participation in the tournament was bad enough, given the Ireland debacle. But whenever reports emerged about the prostitute Zaya Dehar and Sidney Govou, Franck Ribéry and Karim Benzema, you know, accusations around that matter, you know, the atmosphere around the French camp was poisonous, and it was an attitude problem as well, because the French delegation for that World Cup was one of the biggest. There were a lot of hangers on. French team stayed in the most expensive hotel of any team in the tournament. Their training sessions were usually cut off. There was very little engagement, and that showed in the team's abject performances, and the way the team just completely mutinied under Domenech was an embarrassment. I think in France it was called a moral disaster. And there were inquests after that tournament when France suffered an inevitable exit. Players were banned from representing the team. Other players, well, Karim Benzema, for example, I know it's related to a different matter, his current expulsion from the squad, but that set a tone. It really blotted his copybook from an international point of view, as well as from other players as well. And it was something Thierry Henry mentioned when he said young players just didn't have any respect anymore. There was, for example, his place on the team bus. I can't remember who was in his place. It might have been Samir Nasri. Was on his place in the team bus, and he refused to get up. But I think at 2010, the team was just completely disheartened by being under the auspices of a coach who just was completely out of his depth. And it was a national embarrassment, a national shame for France that they performed so poorly. But from an Irishman's perspective, totally enjoyable to watch.
Yep, I get that.
Yep, totally. Totally got that.
So, what else is left to say about 2010? Because I'm kind of left with 2000. Go ahead, Steve.
2010. You can't really walk away with it without, you know, discussing the Netherlands and how physical that the campaign became. You know, that the shock of just seeing them go for the jugular, you know, and cash in generations worth of the beautiful game, and to see them beaten in the final with their own skills almost. You know, a brand of football that was brought to Spain by Johan Cruyff, and it was just such a symbolic, but you know, it was an ugly, ugly final, but a massively symbolic one.
Was it De Vrij that put his foot in the chest in the opening moments? I don't recall.
Yeah, it's gone, Chris.
Yeah, sorry, I think it was Nigel de Jong's famous stud pin.
That's right, yeah. It was. It was de Jong.
Yep, Nigel de Jong, you're right.
It was. And, you know, it should have been such a feast, you know, a festival of football. It should have been one of the classic, all-time classic World Cup finals. And it wasn't. But it was. It was just stunning. It was absolutely stunning. And, you know, they'd scored goals on the way to the final. You know, you look at Spain kind of like beating everyone 1-0 to get to the final throughout the knockout stages. But, you know, the Netherlands had been, you know, relatively expansive. You know, they played very well against Brazil in the quarterfinals. They put two past Slovakia, two past Brazil. Needed three goals to see off Uruguay, you know, in the semi-finals. But then to get to the final and approach it so, so differently. And again, it was just how sensory it really bludgeoned the senses, you know, growing up on, you know, the stories and the deeds of a Netherlands side that always put style first, and this was, you know, it just felt like the breaking of the camel's back. It was kind of like, here are the Netherlands, and they're putting style to the side, they're brushing style aside to try and get the job done. You know, and a third World Cup final and a third one lost, but for the first time, one that they deserved to lose. And you felt that the Netherlands had somehow received their comeuppance. And that just doesn't sound right at all. That the Netherlands let football down somehow in the way they approached that final, because it was just so un-Netherlands, that we've said it, un-Germanic, and you know, but for other things, but yeah, just not like the Netherlands at all, and I don't think they've ever really got over that in many respects.
Yeah, it caught me by surprise, the physicality and the Mourinho-like tactics, yeah. And the
it was brutal at times.
Yeah. Negativity of the game,
that bid to kind of like knock Spain out of their stride, and you know, the fact that it didn't work, you know, and that's the beauty of it, is that it didn't work, and you know, thankfully it didn't, but yeah, that is just one of those images that stays in the mind, and it takes away, you know, we'll speak about 2014, how one specific game can make you forget about so many other incidents at a World Cup. like Uruguay's run to the quarter, to the semi-finals in this one, like Ghana being on the brink of being the first African semi-finalists. You know, South Korea and Japan made the last 16. You know, for two AFC sides to make the knockout stages, you know, all five South Americans making it through. There were just so many, you know, positive aspects of this World Cup that kind of go forgotten in the wake of Spain winning it. But the Netherlands and their approach to trying to stop Spain winning it.
So, Chris, what are your final thoughts on the 2010 World Cup?
I think it's worth noting that before this tournament began, the coverage and the build-up was about, you know, could an African country pull this off? And there was a lot of coverage about the South African murder rate. There was a lot of coverage about the violent crimes and the lack of infrastructure. And I think I've already mentioned that from a sporting perspective, this was a disappointment. But from every other viewpoint, it was a roaring success. And the South African bid and the chairman, Danny Jordan, I know he's had a checkered history since, but the tournament was really handled with aplomb, and credit goes to the South African nation for carrying this off. And it's also worth giving a special note to the way Ghana really represented the continent in this tournament. It was after the victory against the USA where Andre Ayew said, you know, we did this for the continent of Africa. So Ghana, I think it was only their second appearance at a World Cup, really proved what an African team was capable of doing. And it's a shame that their tournament ended in the way that it did, but they covered themselves and their continent in glory.
I think that's great. And I will echo that sentiment and say that that I believe that that while I support 100% a World Cup in Africa, I wish that there would have been more support after the World Cup. I'll just say that. So let's move on to 2014, which was held in Brazil once again. And, you know, a wild World Cup from my perspective. And the Netherlands came back. Costa Rica might have been one of the teams of the tournament. USA did pretty well. Stephen, why don't you kick us off with a little preview of 2014?
Yeah, I mean, 2014, I think a lot of people looked at it from a distance thinking, oh, this will be great because it's football going home. And for Brazil, the natural heirs to a World Cup, you know, everyone always looks towards Brazil to as a moral compass for the World Cup. And then here it was going back to Brazil. And yet from a distance and the closer it got, you know, the reports of social unrest and that there were protests about the World Cup coming, which, you know, from the outside looking in, and I don't know enough about it, it just struck a, you know, it kind of burst the balloon a little bit, because it's humanity at the end of the day. And this was like taking the World Cup back to those early ones where we'd spoken about, you know, history swirling around a World Cup, be it 1938 and France, Argentina, 78, and so many other World Cups, you know, 82 and the Falklands War hanging over it. Then, you know, suddenly you've got a country that is far from at peace with itself. And again, it's this first World Cup on South American soil since Argentina 78, which we've all been in full agreement that it was a World Cup where there was a front of shop image, yet a lot of darkness behind the scenes. And sadly, Brazil kind of offered a similar kind of front of shop. You know, the puppetry that was designed to distract from what was going on in the street. And again, it's one of those things where you as you grow up, you become more aware of it, and you can't allow those side issues to fall away quite so easily. You know, it sits that little less, you know, it's uneasy on your shoulders. And yeah. It took away for me.
Yeah, you know, I'm an old social warrior, right? So I understand those issues, and I commented on those issues at the time, and I know PEC 37, and I know a lot of people who were in the streets at the time, and it was rough, right? I mean, there was some rough stuff that happened in Brazil 2014. And, you know, this podcast is not a political podcast, and I'm happy to engage with anyone one-on-one to talk about that stuff. But we're here to talk football. So, you know, the football that took place in 2014 was pretty interesting stuff, you know. I thought that it was pretty interesting from, you know, especially a European point of view, right? Because the Europeans wanted to really prove that they could win in South America, didn't they, Chris?
Yeah, absolutely. And a tournament in Brazil has special significance because of the football's heritage in the country. And Brazil, given that they were the hosts, had a strong squad, were perhaps the tournament favourites, as well as Leo Messi's Argentina. So the Europeans knew in advance of this tournament that a win would really be a magnificent achievement. But the Europeans had several strong sides going into this tournament. Of course, the eventual winners, Germany, were really reaching the apex of the development and strategic program they had implemented after Euro 2000. This felt like everything was coming together. We had a rejuvenated England team who were going for the complete opposite of the setup they had in 2010, and with the isolation in Rustenburg. They were based in a city centre hotel. There was a lot of interaction and things for the players to do. They were still rubbish, of course, but there was a much more optimism under Roy Hodgson. Spain were still amongst the favourites, winning three international tournaments in a row. Ironically, one of the best performing nations, Holland, were under a manager whose reputation had somewhat not been dragged to the mud, but, you know, Van Gaal had been hurt by the situation at Ajax, where he was ousted by Cruyff-led revolution basically in Amsterdam. So this tournament was crucial for Van Gaal, and the performances of his team here really played a part in him getting the Manchester United job. So there was a lot for the Europeans to play for here. It was Brazil 2014 was a prize boon.
Yeah, I mean, LVG did really well in the group stage, didn't he? I mean, 3-0. 10 goals for, 3 against, knocked Spain out. Spain was done.
Not only knocked them out, but really obliterated them. And, you know, we all know, you probably all remember the shock of that result, that 5-1 victory, and that outstanding Robin van Persie goal, the sort of swan dive header.
Oh, that was incredible.
Yeah, one of the best goals of the tournament. And, of course, Aaron Robin taking on half the team, running across half the pitch to score. But Holland really tore Spain apart there, and that was the Spanish campaign done. It was the end of the Spanish era of dominance.
It was until this summer, because I'm picking Spain to win the World Cup this summer. So. But, you know, it was kind of a resurgence, right? Because I feel like 2014 was the resurgence of countries like France, right? France won their group. Germany won their group. Belgium won their group. The Netherlands, Brazil. I mean, it was kind of like all the expected teams won their group. So there wasn't a lot of surprise coming into the knockout stage of 2014. What do you think, Stephen?
Yeah, I think Italy aside, for a second successive World Cup, they fell at the group stages to, the surprise of the tournament, one of the stories of the tournament in Costa Rica, that fantastic run to the quarterfinals to get so close to the semifinals, within a penalty shootout of the semifinals, and it was an act of beauty to be drawn into the group that they were drawn into, Uruguay, Italy, and England, and then to not just go through but to top that group was phenomenal. I think it was one of the greatest World Cup stories of all time. Apart from Group D, where Italy and you can argue England, but I think anyone going into that group would have said tooth and three. So, for England not to make it through wasn't that much of a surprise. But Costa Rica to go through and go through as group winners was just a seismic shock. Apart from that, everything else seemed to revert to type. And the Netherlands, you can go back to the Netherlands there, and Van Gaal surprised many of us. My feeling about Van Gaal was that he never really moved on from the style of football or his take on the game from the mid to late 1990s. He was one of these coaches that never really took on new inventions, new coaching, new theories, and adapted them to his style of play in the way that Gus Hiddink seemed to, as a comparison. But
how Zlatan feels about him, right?
Yeah. Well, exactly. But I think within this, he just kind of like, I don't know whether it was just luck or what it was, he was just in the right place at the right time, and it was refreshing having seen what happened with them in 2010, but to come back with a much more stylistic approach in 2014 was brilliant. But within that, it's been shocking to see them fall away in the way that they have. But that great generation of players moved on, and those who've come along to replace them just haven't been of the calibre. But that Netherlands run was brilliant. They again were one of the stories. But this is the sleight of hand about the 2014 World Cup, is that 7-1 for Brazil to lose to Germany in Belo Horizonte in the semi final just puts everything else into the shade for this World Cup. I mean, Brazil conceded 10 goals over the course of the semi-final and the third-place playoff, because, it goes forgotten, but the third-place playoff, the Netherlands won 3-0 against Brazil. And it was just an utter, utter shock to see a nation that you expect to be so strong and just to be this barometer of all that is great in football, to be so vulnerable, and that's the word, vulnerable to such a pasting, and then again in the third place playoff. And with, again, Costa Rica's run to the quarterfinals, the Netherlands doing so well, it's all largely forgotten because of that one result. And Germany's eventual success, Germany's masterstroke as well in dispensing with the iconic second kit, the green shirt, to take on the colours of Flamenco, the red and black hoops, to win over the public, because the public at a World Cup will obviously get behind the nation. But they look to incoming nations to arrive at a World Cup bearing gifts, with the smiles and the feel good factor for a World Cup, and Germany brought that very un-Germanic again, but they were the feel good factor. They brought the feel good factor to a World Cup all of a sudden. Football on its head.
Yeah. Full disclosure: I'm wearing the Thomas Müller number 13 jersey from the 2014 World Cup right now.
Excellent, Jim. Good choice. Good choice.
But, you know, I am a Thomas Müller fan, and I am Germanic, so I have to do it. But I'm really not that much of a Die Mannschaft fan. But Thomas Müller, to me, is someone who exercises everything perfect about the game of football. And to me, that is what I like. So, but Chris, you know, when you look at Brazil 2014, and you say, okay, it's a World Cup, it's back in Brazil. Yeah, it's controversial. Yeah, it's, you know, it's crazy. But should Brazil have been better prepared to meet Germany?
I think it's not so much a question of preparation as it is a question of psychology. I think Brazil let the occasion get better of them. And this wasn't just for the Germany game. This was throughout every game that Brazil played at that tournament. And if you watch the players during the national anthem, there's a crazed, almost manic look of nationalism and patriotism in their eyes. And, you know, that sort of stuff is good up to a certain point. But when the whistle blows, it has to be about the game and the game itself. And I think that the players took on too much of that off-field responsibility. I think that's a failure of the coaching staff. Billy Powell, who after the 2002 heroics, was brought back in, and he didn't manage expectations as well as he could have. But I think the team was weaker, perhaps, than it had been at any point over the past maybe 10, 15 years. I think in Fregi, they had a striker who was good, but not good enough for a team of this calibre. They had a player in Neymar who, whilst brilliant, is a consummate individualist who cares more about winning the Ballon d'Or and raising his own profile than winning something for the national team. Having said that, he was the difference, the X factor in this team, and the way he hurt his back against Colombia really derailed Brazil's chances. And whenever he went down under that injury, I think it was by Zuniga, you know, the panic in the stadium, the sort of disbelief, this, oh no, this can't have happened, it was almost uncomfortable to watch. There was too much riding on this tournament from a Brazilian perspective. And I think that is partly because of the situation off the field. You know, the protests and the spending and the politicking around the bidding process and the way stadiums were allocated in the country, all against the backdrop of, you know, public transport not being funded properly, wages falling, and of course later that year Brazil would suffer an economic crisis, Dilma Rousseff would be impeached. You know, Brazilian society was teetering on the edge at this point. There was almost an uncontrollable urge to express something like frustration and you know, despair about, not to be too grandiose, but how the country was and what direction it was heading in. And too much was riding on this tournament to give Brazil a positive image of itself. And when that came apart at the seams, it was desperate. I don't think it'll have the same sort of lasting impact as the Maracanazo in 1950. You know, attention spans are shorter now. People move on quicker than they did perhaps back then. But having said that, the result and the performance, especially in the Germany game, but probably throughout the tournament, you know, it will leave an indelible mark on Brazilian society.
So here's a question for you that has nothing to do with football, but how much do you think the Olympics played into the consciousness of the World Cup?
I don't think it probably head too much into it. I think in Brazil, the World Cup is always going to matter more than the Olympics. But again, the way that that process was arbitrated, you know, the spending, the sort of the this desire to trim the hedges and mow the lawn so the watching world can get a good impression of the country, all the while its citizens can't get secure jobs or fair wages or, you know, have a future for their children. You know, people don't like that. And this World Cup especially was at the height of the dissatisfaction with FIFA as an organisation. You know, we'd had the White Elephant Stadiums in South Africa. We'd had the official food and drink sponsors of the tournament who were the only outlets allowed to sell their wares within a mile radius of the ground. You know, the corporatism was just too much at this stage. There was too much obfuscation, too much talk of legacy and benefits that everyone knew would never reach their pockets, this sort of trickle-down wealth. And I think that reflected a sort of a more general sort of dissatisfaction with how life was at that stage, not just in Brazil, but throughout the continent and probably much of the Western world. I think there was far less patience for this sort of corporate glee than there might have been even 10 years before.
So, Stephen, given with what Chris said, which I agree with 100%, the fact that Brazil hosted two events so close together, what do you think the people of Brazil would, what do you think they were more excited about, the World Cup or the Olympics?
Oh, definitely the World Cup, you would imagine. You know, Brazil's just so intrinsic when it comes to football. You know, it is. You know, I mean, England gave, historically, they gave football to the world, but it belongs to Brazil. Now, the ball belongs to Brazil. And, you know, it should have been a joyful thing for that World Cup to go to Brazil. And it was to an extent, you know, but it was also used as a political tool to beat itself. But no, the World Cup would have been the all-encompassing event, because this was, you know, you can't underestimate just the damage that 1950 did to Brazil, and this was the opportunity to expunge that, you know, because no matter what Brazil have done over the years, you know, those multiple World Cup successes, Brazil tends to dwell on its failings more than it does its successes. So 1950 has just been this huge ghost that hung on the wall. The 1982 team, lamented for its failure to win with such beauty of football. And then now you've got 2010, and maybe this 2010 won't haunt, you know, generations of Brazilians, modern Brazilians, like previous failures have, but it will still be there. It will still hurt. It will still rankle. And in a way, that's what makes it so interesting to see how Brazil bounced back from that in 2018. Just what that cataclysmic result for Brazil to lose 7-1 on home soil in that semi-final against Germany, and the vulnerability that it created. Just what kind of mental fatigue will have that rendered on Brazil? Well, and the interesting thing will be
that's a question, Stephen, because 7-1 is a tattoo. It's not a.
It is. It's. You know, they've been embossed with that, and there'll be no shaking that. And well, as much as modern football is different, and younger generations shake things off in a way that, you know, they don't let the past dwell or the history loom as large as our generations do and previous generations.
I don't believe that still, for a second.
It still will rankle, even if it's just subconsciously. You know, there was a haunted look on many Brazilian players' faces from word go at that tournament. And that's because of the weight of 1950. They carried the weight of 1950 into the 2014 finals. And in that opening game where they went 1-0 down, an own goal, I think it was, Marcelo, possibly. And I can just remember, I can still picture him. He had the look of shock and devastation in his eyes, in his face, that it's like, oh my God, what have I done? You know, this is meant to be absolution for 1950, not adding more pain to the scenario. But they did, you know, and the big question is, can Brazil ever get over that? And what they need to do to get over that is to win a World Cup. And what better way to win a World Cup but to do it on European soil as well?
Do it against Germany if they can, but you know, Spain if they can't, but you know.
But just huge. You can't underestimate, you can't undersell how cataclysmic, how seismic that defeat was. Just changed football completely, the way that you view it. You know, the whole landscape changed for a European nation to go to South America and win it, but not just do that, but to steamroll the Brazil in the process. You know, it really did change everything. All preconceptions changed. You know, with that game, any nagging doubts that were there, you know, were just laid naked.
Yeah, it was a horrifying landscape for any Brazilian fan. But 2014 had some beautiful moments too. So, you know, Chris, the Costa Rican run in 2014 had to have been fun to watch for you.
Oh, absolutely. The way they qualified at England's expense, it's always satisfying. But I think even from a neutral's perspective, the way Costa Rica made it all the way to the quarterfinals, there was everything, there was a lot to be taken from it. This was a team who, apart from the likes of Joel Campbell and Brian Ruiz and Keylor Navas, was a team of nobodies, basically. And they were in a group that was regarded as one of the more difficult in the tournament, alongside Uruguay. And they still managed to do it, but they did it in a way that emphasized the collective. Campbell might have been the star on the field, but it was the team's coherence and cohesiveness that was the most impressive aspect of the performance. And they could have made it to the semi-final as well had Van Gaal not pulled that infamous penalty trick, taking off Jasper Cillessen and bringing on Tim Krul. It's arguably one of the most impressive, probably the most impressive performance from a CONCACAF nation in World Cup history. I don't think they'll be anywhere near as impressive this time around, unfortunately.
No, but they won't.
But that's merely a regression to the mean. Sometimes the World Cup, you see these minnows outperform and exceed expectations, a la South Korea in 2002, Cameroon in 1990. And I think these are the teams you remember, the teams that upset your expectations. You know, there's very little joy in seeing the heavyweights smash up the little kids, so to speak. Costa Rica really did a lot to reawaken the joy of the World Cup with their performances. And Joel Campbell, in that tournament, you know, he's technically still an Arsenal player 4 years later. He's had a very nomadic career, but at that tournament, he really showcased his ability and has arguably been quite unlucky not to be given an extended run on the Arsenal team for whatever reason. But he's a tremendous player on his day. So too Brian Ruiz, who's past his best at Sporting Lisbon now, but, you know, as a number 10, he was languidly brilliant. and Keylor Navas, of course, underappreciated at Real Madrid, but was tremendous throughout that tournament, probably one of the teams and the tournament's best players. There was a lot to be taken from the Costa Ricans' performances there, I have to say.
No, I agree. So full disclosure, my boss is Costa Rican, and my other boss, is a Turkish man who's from Frankfurt. So Hikmet Ersek was the chairman of Western Union. So, but my immediate boss is Costa Rican, so I have to give a shout out to Harrison. But
what are Harrison's memories of that tournament? I'm sure it's a very fond time for him.
You know, I'll have to ask Harrison. He and I don't talk a lot of football because he's very busy, and so am I. So, but Costa Rica in 4 years ago was just, they were a great story, but there were other good stories too as well. Germany, we have to all give it up to Germany, right? They just freaking steamrolled that tournament, did they not, Stephen?
Oh, totally. I've spoken so many times about Germany and, people just expecting them to deliver. But I think that's the great thing about the modern Germany is that they had that very, very pronounced decline by German standards, at the very least, in the late 90s into the early 2000s. When England went to Munich and put five past them, poor European championships in 2000, 2004. They got to the 2002 World Cup final, but the luckiest World Cup finalists, ever, possibly only rivaled by Argentina in 1990. And there was, there had to be a complete sea change within Germany. By the time they hosted in 2006, they were seen in their homeland as the underdogs. They were put into a very, very different situation, a different classification, but the nation got behind them in a way, almost in a very English way. This team we have, are fighting hard, but they're not very, they're not the best team that we've ever seen. But the nation fell for them, and that under Klinsmann energized Germany in a way that I don't think anything else could have done at the time. And since then, they've just gone on in such a marked progression, and reinvented themselves under Joachim Löw, and they hit peak perfection at Euro 2014. At the 2014 World Cup. They come close in a couple of Euros, but then here they are, just blossoming again. And this was, Germany at the best, but also playing football with a smile on their face. That dismantling of Brazil was, it was just a work of art. It was such good football to watch, which kind of made it just so amazing. It just made the whole event so amazing. The way that Brazil were dismantled, the way that they fell apart, the fact that Brazil could lose on home soil by 7-1, but the way that Germany just dismantled them, they looked capable of scoring every time they went forward in that match. And then by the time you got to the final, you just felt there was only going to be one winner, despite the fact that it was Argentina on the home continent with the world's best player in their side, in Lionel Messi. And Germany just, they were the right winners of the tournament. And to say that on a World Cup that's on South American soil is just so, so wild. It still blows the mind to think about it. But this World Cup win should be up there, heralded as amongst the very, very best, if not the greatest, World Cup achievements of all time.
By the way, have you ever seen anyone win player of the tournament and just look like they never wanted to be there more than Leo Messi?
Exactly.
I mean, he looked like he wanted to be somewhere 1,000 miles away.
Yep. And the fact that, you know, he walked away from the international game for, a reasonable amount of time on the back of that as well. You know, the pain that that caused him.
Well, let's be serious, right? The AFA is a mess, right? The Argentinian Federation, they're a mess. And I think Sampaoli's a mess, right? I think this, I mean, I'll be serious with you. We're getting into 2018 here, but I think Argentina is a mess. But, I feel bad for Leo Messi because I think he's been given a raw deal by his country. But, you know, when you look at that final, and I look at the way that final goal was scored from André Schürrle coming down the left-hand side, passing that ball into Mario Götze. You know, I'm looking at two substitute players here, basically, right? I mean, one, I don't even know where André Schürrle plays now. Does he play for Wolfsburg?
I think that was where he was the last I'd...
Sure.
Oh, no, he's at Dortmund, sorry. He moved on to Dortmund.
He's at Dortmund now, okay. And so Mario Götze is, like, in between clubs at the moment. You know, we're talking about two players who, we're not talking about Thomas Müller, we're not talking about, Mario Klose, we're not talking about the biggest stars on the planet here. We're talking about secondary players that Jurgen Love brought in the late stages of that match because he knew they could make a difference. And that is the genius of Jurgen Love. And that's why I love this Germany team. You can't hate them because they're so friggin' perfect.
Yeah, I think that's you've nailed it there, Jim. You've nailed it. But within that, I think they've also, managed to make themselves, human. You know, they always felt, German sides have always felt robotic. They've always felt metronomic, constructed. And, that old, awful German stereotype of efficient. But they just seemed, always seemed a certainty, mechanical in some way. But that fall from grace that they had to reassemble and to rebuild and come back again with a younger generation, with a different system, with a new way of looking at football, and to play, with a freedom that they hadn't always embraced. Germany became likable. That's the thing. Germany made themselves likable. They brought themselves a human kind of aura, and 2014 was the fruition of that. And that's the beauty of 2018, is that suddenly there's this kind of rancor building up behind the scenes that is just so un-German. But again, it hints at, humanity. It hints at, this growing kind of embracing the human side of football and life in a way that the German national team never really has. And it's almost been like a decade of this now, and suddenly this is just great. It's great watching Germany.
Chris has something to say.
Yeah, well, when we talk about the human face of the German triumph, I think it's worthwhile also pointing out that this really is a triumph of planning long-term and a triumph of vision and management. You know, back in the early 2000s when Jurgen Klinsmann really came in and was responsible for orchestrating this strategy in cahoots with Oliver Bierhoff, the former striker turned general manager. You know, everything was meticulously planned to deliver this World Cup. And if you take the example of the training base, the Campo Bahia, which Bierhoff masterminded, the German Football Federation spent 40 million euros building a specific World Cup base. It's now an eco-tourist resort in Santo André. But can you imagine the headlines if the English FA spent a similar amount on an England training base for the World Cup? It would lead to a massive outcry. But Germany saw a vision for how they wanted their football to be played. They put the structures in place. They got the buy-in from their clubs and their national league. And they spent the money. They developed the plans and they executed them brilliantly. And Benedikt Höwedes had said that the conditions of the 2014 World Cup played a huge part in making the players feel comfortable, feel like they were really being invested in, that everything was being catered to them so that they could perform it to the best of their ability. And it's clear in the way Germany performed in 2014. Everything was fluid. Everything was planned and everything was almost uncriticizable, if there's such a word. Having said that, it wasn't all smooth sailing. That Algeria side gave them arguably the toughest game of the tournament. Arguably should have beaten them. You know, the team of Yassine Brahimi and Sofiane Feghouli. You know, Algeria were incredible and were very unlucky to go out.
There was a lot of historical bearing on that game that goes back to that incident in 82, where West Germany and Austria facilitated a result that saw Algeria out. You know, the enthusiasm, not the enthusiasm, but you know, the personal aspect of that for Algeria was absolutely massive, which is again, you know, one of those in just little sideshows of a World Cup that tend to fall under the radar. But there was something personal in that for Algeria. But sorry, Chris, carry on there. I've just wanted to wear that one.
That was an extra incentive for that game, but throughout the tournament in general, Algeria were very impressive, particularly how stodgy they were 4 years before. But Germany overcame that game. And from then on, they didn't really seem like they were in too much difficulty. I think the comment regarding Leo Messi is quite interesting, because Argentina's starting centre-backs for that game were Martin Demichelis, who was past his prime, and Ezequiel Garay, who I think might have been playing in Russia. And Argentina's problems with defence and goalkeeping have only got worse in the intervening 4 years. It's very much Leo Messi and no one else. And, you know, when he's fine and fit, that's okay. You know, he can come off the bench in a World Cup qualifier against Bolivia and score 3 goals to secure a qualification. But when he's not fit, as he wasn't in 2014, you know, I know they reached the final, but they weren't impressive in getting there. I remember the game against Bosnia where it was Messi again who scored a last-minute winner. It'll be interesting to see how they get on in Russia. I can't see it. I can't see them winning anything. I would love to, because Messi has this thing hanging around his neck, despite leading his country to 4 finals, losing all 4, not always because of, you know, problems with his effort. In the 2014 final, of course, you have Gonzalo Higuain missing a golden opportunity. So he's been let down by his country, he's been let down by his association, and oftentimes he's let down by his inferior sort of colleagues. So, but you know, history isn't kind to the losers, as we all know. And if Messi doesn't get the winner's medal in 2018, he'll always have that mark against him, unfortunately. But that's history, that's football, and that's life.
Well, as a brilliant Irishman once said, it seems history's to blame. So as we sign off here from our 2010-2014 World Cup reminiscence, I want to say thank you to all of our guests. We've had some wonderful guests along the way, not to mention Chris Weir. I think this has been a brilliant podcast series. I want to thank Stephen, my co-host. Stephen, you've been absolutely brilliant along the way.
Oh, it's been a joy, Jim. It's been an absolute joy to do. Going back all those months when we first discussed this to see it actually come to fruition. And it's been an absolute joy to do. And thank you for having me along for the ride.
Oh, that the night in London that we decided to do this was quite a night, and I'll never forget it.
It was a hell of a night, that was, Jim. It was a hell of a night.
But Chris, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your experiences of 2010 and 2014. It was very much appreciated. So for these football times, this is Jim Hart signing off. Thank you very much.